The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. It is April 6, 2013, and on Monday, April 8, we are going to be commemorating, here in the United States of America, Yom HaShoah Day. Did you know that? Did you ever think that we would be celebrating such a day? Well, we have been since 1982 or so. You know, it's called for us Days of Remembrance of the Holocaust. It's plural, days plural, because it's actually a week long. And I'm going to get into that along with so much else in just a minute. But I also right now want to remind you that April 11th, which is this coming Thursday, Elie Wiesel will be speaking at Kent State University in Ohio. I wrote about it in a post dated March 3rd at my website, Elie Wiesel Cons the World. I encourage those living in Ohio and in nearby points in Pennsylvania to try to get a group to go there to do some demonstrating with signs on the campus and in front of the stadium where people will arrive to hear him speak, but there don't seem to be any takers. I'm not too surprised, really. It's a big logistical job. It's not so easy that you just make a sign, go off, you know, drive over there, drive up there, drive down there, and, you know, walk around and do something useful. I mean, it doesn't really work that way. And, we were reading, in the International Jew in recent days, in recent episodes, how the Jews can put together a massive meeting almost overnight. And, yet, you know, we can't even get a few people to go to a university when Elie Wiesel is appearing there in person. But it's a lot different for us because there's a ton of security for this man more than ever before, and they're looking out for people who would come and do this. Since last year somebody did when he was at another university in Ohio around this time. And So, it's not that easy, and you can go through a lot of work and it doesn't do any good in the end, because they as soon as they see you, they drive you away and kick you out and so on. So, it's too bad that we can't do more things like this. But I do realize, the difficulties, and everybody thinks they have something probably better to do, more useful to do than to do this. Well, anyway, he's going to be there, and we'll see. Maybe something will happen, but I haven't heard from anyone about it. Now, there is this does bear somewhat on today's program, but before I get to that, I want to mention about donations. I just yesterday discovered quite a few donations that I was unaware of because I had not visited the PayPal accounts, and I had always gotten emails from PayPal when I had a donation, and came right into my email immediately, and I hadn't gotten any lately. I thought, you know, I didn't go to look until one person was concerned whether I got it or not, and after he checked around a bit, he was a little unhappy, and I do apologize to him. He should have been, but that got me to go and look, and gee, to my surprise, I found at the White Network PayPal account a very large donation from Ron from Colorado. I don't want to overestimate so you think, you know, it's something gigantic, but it's quite big for us, and I could hardly believe it when I saw the figure on there. I'm not going to say what it is, but I want to thank, you know, of course, we do thank Ron very much, and hope that he continues to remember us. He also said he had sent a large contribution to Vincent Renoir and his dear partner, Marie. And I was very happy to hear that because they are well-deserving and they definitely do need it. So I'm glad that there may be others who have been sending to Vincent since his last show. And I'm really glad that if that's happening. Now, others who donated to the White Network since, sometime after March 15th until now, are Franklin from the Netherlands, Kevin from, I won't say where, Dimitar from Ontario, Thaddeus from Pennsylvania, and Thomas from Kentucky. And these are all friends of the White Network. I thank you very much. I did send out thank you emails to you all yesterday after I saw your donations, and I'm a little late for some, but I explained that. So I also have a CarolynJaeger.com email account, and this is a little tricky now. I hadn't been getting emails about that either, which I had previously, but you know, I've changed that email to CarolynJaeger.net, and well, it was changed, but now it's CarolynJaeger.com is being blocked because I had somebody who was using it. How they got to use it, I don't know. But so now I guess that's the reason. Well, you know, I've changed my mailing emails to on both of these accounts, and although the one hasn't gone through yet because they had some technical problems on their site yesterday, I will go back this evening probably and try to fix that. So they are starting to come to me. The notifications are starting to come to me again. You know, I've changed that email, mailing email to CarolynJaeger.net. Some of that might be the problem, but it's not. There's no problem in your money getting there. You know, because that account is named CarolynJaeger.com. It doesn't matter that there's no CarolynJaeger.com anymore. That's the name of the PayPal account, and I would have to, I think, change the name on the PayPal account, and that's not easy. And rather than do that, I will look into it, but probably it might just stay this way. So I hope that doesn't confuse people, that the PayPal account is CarolynJaeger.com, but my site is CarolynJaeger.net and doesn't respond to CarolynJaeger.com anymore. Well, these things, you know, I never thought about all these things when started out. You know, when I started out making this decision and that decision, I forget about it. And I've got so many passwords, and I've got them written all up in a little book. And thank goodness I got that, because I have to get more and more difficult passwords, where I used to just use something simple, like, you know, something I could remember and associate with it. Well, I've learned not to do that anymore with all these programs that figure this stuff out. So, I have to have these passwords. I could never remember them in a million years. Actually, there's one. The one I do remember. It's not that hard, but it's weird. So, I can only remember so much, you know. I want to. Did I mention the people? Yeah, at CarolynJaeger.com.net is. I got donations. Very nice again from Carl from Minnesota. He's such a good friend a friend to me. He sends donations to my account, from Dimitar, who sends to both, and from Paul from California. And I just want to thank all these people for their support, and it's very, very important, very necessary for us. And also it cheers us up so much, you know. It's so encouraging to know that that we have people who are listening and like it enough that they will actually send some money. Now, I want also to tell you that Hadding Scott is going to be doing the Heretics Hour again, for me on Monday. And he will, I don't know what his topic will be. I suggested he continue what he said he hadn't gotten all organized last week, but he said, you know, and said, well, not to say that because he might change his mind. So, and then on April 15th, a week from Monday, I'm going to have another guest host, Harlan Schulke, and everybody likes him. I mean, a lot of people like him is what I mean to say. And I know he's going to do a good program. So I'm real happy that these two men are standing in for me and giving me some time that I really, really need for some other areas of my life. And also just for some of my website work. I'm way behind. I'm always going to be behind, but I have to catch up a little. I have to, you know, get something accomplished once in a while. So, but I will plan to return after the 15th and do it myself for a while. But I probably will be looking now and then for a substitute because, I'm finding that, I've got way too much to do and it's the only way I can do it. And I think it brings on some new people and it's a very good, you know, it's very good for all of us. So, thanks to all of you who have appreciated having a show last week. And, now I want to move on because I have lots of material as usual, more than probably I can get to, which really pains me because I want to get to every bit of it. so I will say that don't call in until the second hour. And, even at that point, you know, when I start getting these programs ready, I think, well, I guess I'm going to be on by myself, but I'd like to talk about this and that. And then I think, oh, well, I don't know, I'm going to have enough for 2 hours. And, boy, you know, well, maybe I'll get some phone calls and I'll tell people to call in. And then by the time the program starts, I've done so much work because I want everything to be right and good and have plenty of material that, I'm thinking, well, how do I have time for a caller? And then this is very rude. It's terrible. You know, it's terrible to have a phone line, to have a live show and, you know, invite people to call and then feel like you don't have time, for the call. So I want to say, we'll see how it goes. And, if you, you know, have something that you, if you have something you think would really add to the program, well, call in, or you can always add it in a comment after the program. I don't want to discourage callers, but actually I don't get very many callers. So, we'll just see how it goes. I'm going on too much and I want to get down to business here. So I want to give you the main point that I want to make tonight because there's a main point that is, can be said in a few words, but then I have a lot to illustrate it and I think it's all important as illustration, but that's me. So if I just get this main point down, right off the bat, it's good. And my main point is that we cannot break the hold of the Holohoax as long as Jews remain in power as they are, and even if they had somewhat less power than they have now. I mean, even if they were much less powerful, if they were in our society, working freely, you know, having the rights of everybody else and not being concerned with having any restrictions on them. My phone is ringing. It disturbed me. And then, you know, we're going to have a problem. And I talked about this on the March 25th Heretics Hour program. And then I wrote it up in an article that I titled Thoughts on the Jewish Problem and the Holohoax. And you can find it as a blog on the White Network and also at carolynyager.net. And I would like you to read it if you haven't already read it. And I'm also going to repeat these ideas today in order to really drive them home in our people's minds because most of our people are really resistant to them, I think, and even afraid of them, even afraid to say, oh, we cannot accomplish any of our goals as long as Jews remain powerful in our society. And I'll go on to say that there is no way to break the power of Jews in our society or any society if they're there. And this people say, oh, well, are we so weak? Are we so, you know, we should just, you know, it's our problem. We need to just stop that. Well, when you learn about how Jews work and you see how Jews have managed to do what they do all throughout history, and particularly in modern history, because these kinds of ideas have gained hold as just the general proper way of thinking that, you know, all people are equal and society should be open to everyone and, you know, and it's whoever does the best job, you know, gets the gold and so on. And that's just the way, you know, nobody can really argue against this very well anymore. And so we're prey to this kind of group of people that the Jews are. So I'll go on here. As long as Jews are free and fully emancipated, living among us as competitors, we cannot break the hold of the Holocaust and the other false history that surrounds it. That's all of the revisionist history that is really so important. And Ron of Colorado, our big donor, when I wrote to thank him, he wrote back and he did make a comment and say that it was absolutely essential that we correct the historical record. And, you know, this is, I agree with this wholeheartedly. I am basically more of a revisionist and a revisionist of history and the Holocaust than I am actually a white nationalist. I am a white nationalist, but, you know, this other is what I feel is more truly my calling and my field and what I'm most concerned about doing. And it really, really gets me turned on. So, I say that we have to do this. You know, we have to break the hold of this. And no matter how many more revisionist books are published, and there's a lot of, you know, good people, they're writing and publishing these books, and, you know, we look forward to them, but they don't change much, even though they add to the information that we have. But no matter how many we publish, the hoaxers will publish more of their books, and whether we publish them or not, they're going to publish their books. And they're going to put them into more hands. And even if a majority of people realize that the Holocaust story as it is impossible, you know, and there's a lot of people who, if they honestly, if they were asked the question the right way, would say, oh, they don't know whether they believe about the 6 million number. They don't know whether they believe about this. They don't know whether they believe about the other thing. But, you know, they will still say, they believe the whole thing, you see. They just can't deal. They can't separate all that out. And so even if they know that the story or many parts of the story is impossible, they won't go against the authority of governments, courts, and universities as to the correct historical facts. Otherwise, the consensus, you know. And the consensus has been formed in large part by powerful Jews. And of course, a lot that go along with them, but powerful Jews are in government. And of course, they're in the courts and they're all over the universities. But, governments are the major funders of universities today. And of course, the courts are part of the government. So the biggest power is government, and governments control the people's treasury. You know, whoever is your government, you've handed everything over to them. And we now have governments that are totally traitorous to the people. So this is what I want you to really hear, and I'm going to go on about this a bit. First, I want to mention this picture I used in the where did it go? I lost it because – oh, here it is still. This picture I used in my announcement for today's show, and I will use it for the program post, I guess, because I just couldn't get over it. I thought it was so informative. It's a picture from last year's Yom HaShoah ceremony in Israel, in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. And this is titled that the World War II veterans attend a wreath-laying ceremony. I found this at The Guardian. The Guardian had an article from from last year, and if you just Google Guardian and the title Holocaust Remembrance Day in pictures, you should find it if you want to look at. There's three pictures of these guys, and this I use this one because, well, it showed the one with the most medals, the one standing down there. But I suppose that they are Jewish, and I'm quite sure they're all Jews who were in World War II. They found a few. And look at all those medals they have on their jackets. The one guy in the blue cap, I think he would probably be an American. And the guy in the green beret, greenish, dark green beret, I don't know. I think looks British, but it could be French. And then the guys in this picture who's in front, holding the flowers. It's not a wreath, but, well, maybe it is a wreath. flowers. Yeah, it has a Hebrew ribbon around it with Hebrew letters on it. Or is that Russian? Oh, I thought at first that it might be Russian. Anyway, I thought he looked Russian. I thought that was Russian. His medals look kind of Russian to me. Not that I really know, but so you've got these three World War II veterans who are Jews that they found. And what are all these medals? Some of them must be for being a resistance fighter or all the things they've done and being a survivor, you know, talking about it after the war or something. Who knows? But who would have that many medals? It's just ridiculous. And it just shows the ridiculousness of the whole deal. You know, these three guys being so solemn there at this ceremony for remembering the 6 million who were killed and all these Jewish people sitting back there, these Israelis, and, you know, taking it all seriously. And they take it all so seriously, and they're perpetrating this. And they have been all this time. And it, you know, it's when you know that it's a big farce, it's just kind of amazing when you see how it can be carried out. So that's enough for that. I want to say that after the picture, okay, that there is an international, remember, Holocaust Remembrance Day in January of every year. And then there is this Israel Holocaust Remembrance Day or Jewish Holocaust Remembrance Day, whatever you want to call it, in March or April, whenever it falls. There's no fixed date. The thing to notice is that it's set by the Hebrew calendar, the 27th of Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. It's not according to the Gregorian calendar, so it falls at different times according to our calendar, because these calendars don't match at all. So, you know, once again, the Jews have their own calendar, which they use all the time, and their own year numbers, which are now in the 5,000 something, I think, rather than 2,000 like ours. And they have to have everything their own, and they have their own Holocaust Remembrance Day, just the international one that they also worked hard to create and probably were mostly responsible for. That's not good enough. They have to have another one that's their own, they're just for them. And guess who also goes along with it? The United States of America. So in this case, as in so many, Israel leads and we follow. Now, the United Nations General Assembly designated January 27th as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And this is the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And all nations on earth, or all nations that are part of the United Nations, are told they have an obligation to honor the victims of the Nazi era and to develop educational programs to help prevent future genocides. This year's theme is Rescue During the Holocaust, the Courage to Care. Why should we care, I ask, you know, about this theme? But this is a propaganda effort that never ends, you know, that somehow we have to care. We have to care about, this is really indicating that we need to care about every human being on earth, although they're talking always about the Jews. But, you know, we should care about everybody, which is an impossible task. And that's just one aspect of how this twists things up and messes with our minds and causes us to be absolutely nutty trying to live up to these kinds of ideas. And also, I probably got that later on. So, now, in addition to the annual candle lighting ceremony, this year the museum hosted a public program with the Embassy of the Republic of Poland. I wanted to add this, and probably these are things I should leave out if I want to complete this. But it's so typical of how they do things, you know. So we're still talking about the international Holocaust remembers by the United Nations in January. And what they did was they had a program that, you know, the United Nations, did I get into that? The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum Well, I'm almost to that, but they went with the Embassy of Poland in Washington, D.C. They're both in Washington, D.C., so they did this program together. And what was it? They explored the incredible story of Witold Pilecki, a Polish army officer who deliberately entered Auschwitz as a prisoner to collect information on the camp. Okay, that sounds a lot like Dennis Avey, doesn't it? Who snuck in, the man who broke into Auschwitz. Only this one actually, I don't know, he deliberately became a prisoner in order to go to Auschwitz to collect information. So after more than 2.5 years, this story goes, of hard labor and torture, Pilecki accomplished his mission and escaped. So obviously, it was just up to him. He could get in there. He could stay as long as he wanted. It took him 2.5 years of hard labor and torture to get his story that he needed. And when he was ready, he just left. He just escaped, you know. Easy as that. And his report on what he saw was recently translated into English. So he did this event in the 1940s, early 1940s, before 1945, but it was written in Polish, and they just recently translated it into English for this anniversary, because every anniversary, every one of these memorial anniversaries, they have to have something new that they put in the paper and so on. So they came up with this, and the title of his book was The Auschwitz Volunteer Beyond Bravery. Have you ever heard of it? Well, it's another one of those books now. There's thousands of them. If not millions, I don't know. Millions too big of a number, but it's just amazing. So this is the kind of thing that they are putting off on the public. And I want to say now that the museum, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, wrote about this for their International Holocaust Day in January, and then they said that they will also lead the United States in observing the 2013 Days of Remembrance, the nation's annual commemoration of the Holocaust from April 7th through April 14th. So they get USHMM involves itself in both of these commemoration times. And what I notice about this is that they say that they have been given the job of leading the United States. So this museum, which is made up of a pile of Jews, and only Jews running it and working there for the most part, and you don't find too many Gentiles working there, although there are some, of course, because they have to make it, you know, look right, and they probably can't find enough Jews to do everything there. But there, you see Jews are working there and running it for sure. They're all running it. And they say that they represent the nation. They say they're gonna lead the United States in this, the nation's annual commemoration. So this is the United States of America's annual commemoration of the Holocaust. So we like Israel are the only countries that have two commemorations, as far as I know. We go along with the UN one in January, and then we do this other one along with Israel only the month of Nisan, the Hebrew month of Nisan, whenever it falls, sometime in late March or early April. So this is something to really consider. How far gone we are when we have something like this, when we've got a situation like this. So this remembrance that they're talking about, this Days of Remembrance, is Yom HaShoah, Israel's Holocaust Memorial Day. And that's the day, but it's also a week. You know, they'll call it the week of Yom HaShoah. It starts with the day. And it's marked across the country in Israel every year, and it's a national holiday in Israel. Now, it's not a national holiday in the United States, but that's probably something that's further on down the road, ladies and gentlemen, if we don't put a stop to this trend that's going on, this more than a trend, but this direction where we do everything that the Jews ask us to do. And eventually we would be calling it, it would be called Yom HaShoah here in the United States too. And things like that, you know, will be happening. So, in Israel, well, it takes place. The biggest ceremony is at Yad Vashem, their National Holocaust Memorial, in which the president and prime minister deliver speeches, and Holocaust survivors light six torches, symbols of the 6 million Jews who perished, and it goes from sundown to sundown. So this year, it will be tomorrow, starting at sundown tomorrow, April 7th, and continue until sundown, April 8th. That's another thing they do, which is different from the rest of us. We start from midnight and go to the next midnight for our days. Excuse me. But now, since these days of remembrance became established in by an act of Congress, which I'm going to get to right away here, we also have a ceremony in our congressional, in the rotunda of the Congress. And who comes to it? Who came to one of them? The vice president. I don't think the president was there, but the vice president, lots of congressmen, lots of members of the government, and I'm going to list them all in just a minute here. So we're doing this, we're handling it the same way as they do in Israel. And also we're supposed to commemorate it all around the country. Now, this is something that really only the Jews are doing. Nobody else is doing it. But they do manage to get non-Jews to come to their ceremonies and so on. And they give a lot of speeches and things like that. So they manage to do that. And it just will, they'll get it to grow. If they continue to have power, and the kind of power they have, it will continue to become more and more dominant, and they'll just push it out more and more as a Hebrew thing that everybody has to honor and go along with. Now, when the United States Congress established the Days of Remembrance as our nation's annual commemoration of the Holocaust. Now, this is written at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's website. This is how they write it. They say the United States Congress established the Days of Remembrance as our nation's annual commemoration of the Holocaust and created the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum as a permanent living memorial to the victims. Now, we've looked at this, you know, before. I've talked about it before, how wrong it is that this should be here in the United States. But when they talk about it, they're very possessive about this country. And instead of saying that the Congress established this as the nation's annual commemoration, they use the word our. And they're not the only ones who do this, the Jewish organizations who do this. Our. And it doesn't just mean that they're talking about themselves. But they're including themselves in a big way as our nation. This is not, you know, whose nation is this? It's our nation. All of us non-white people, you know, all of us immigrant people, all of us this and that kind of people. It's all of ours. It's not yours is a kind of a message to people like you and I. This tells me that, you know, we have to see this. We have to take this seriously and say, well, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is an Israeli outpost in the United States. It is. Its whole purpose is to promote, remembrance of the Holocaust and the importance of the Holocaust. And this is all for the benefit of Jews around the world and also of Israel. So that's how I see it. You know, it's really an alien entity living amongst us with all kinds of rights that the rest of us don't have, and it was given those things by Congress itself. Now, I'm going to skip this. They say, in accordance with its congressional mandate, the museum is responsible for leading the nation in commemorating the Days of Remembrance. So again, they're tied in. This museum is tied in with all this connection to how we're going to do things following the example of Israel and do all these things about the Jews around the world, here in this country. And they say, congressional mandate that they've been given is for encouraging and sponsoring appropriate observances throughout the United States. So let's remember that taxpayers give over $50 million a year. It's probably more than that now, but that's even just, when all is said and done, with all the probably expense accounts and special projects and special money they get, it's probably cost the taxpayers $500 million a year. I wouldn't be surprised, because that's just the basic grant that they're given, or whatever, the money they're given to operate every year. So since 1982, they say they've been doing this. And here's where they say that the ceremony takes place. This is going to happen on the 8th. We're going to celebrate this day on the 8th, because since it ends at sundown on the 8th, so we do it on the 8th. That would be on Monday. They do it in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, with Holocaust survivors invited, you know, and liberators. I suppose that was some of these guys with all the medals who they have in that Yad Vashem picture that I talked about and used in my announcement. They're probably liberators. And members of Congress and White House officials and the diplomatic corps and community leaders are all in attendance. Well, of course, they get as many people of importance as they can manage to scare to go there, to make it look good. Now, I do know that not everybody in our government and not all these people who've gone along with all this do it with relish, but they do it because they feel they have to do it, and this is what's wrong. Now, another thing to say about this is that this 27th day of Nisan, which on the Hebrew calendar, I guess it's called the Hebrew calendar, the reason they chose that for this remembrance, their big anniversary day, is because it marks the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And of course they have all their story about a Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and how these people were treated and how these brave Jews figured out how to, you know, revolt and when they did it, but they got beaten down eventually by the Germans. But they want to put this in history as a great noble fighting spirit of the Jews, because in the Holocaust, one of the things is that in the so-called Holocaust, that the Jews didn't fight back. The Jews weren't fighting. They were just, I don't know, some of them were trying to protect their wealth, some of them were going off somewhere else. They didn't care about the others. There was no love for one another in this Jewish Holocaust, as they put it. And they, you know, when Israel was first formed, and those who were trying to form it, you know, for quite a while, 20 years or so before 1948, they were not interested in the Holocaust. Well, some of it. The Holocaust came after that. So in 1948 in Israel, Holocaust survivors kept quiet because nobody was interested in them. People looked down on them because they saw them as weak people who didn't fight. And this was not the image that Israel had now. Israel had this great image, you know, that they were promoting, and partly happened with that movie Exodus, which I fell for hook, line, and sinker. I was, you know, at an age, I thought that was just so, so wonderful. But they weren't interested in the Holocaust, and they weren't interested in these people. But in time, they began to see the advantages in it. And of course, in the 50s, they were negotiating with Germany for all this, compensation money. And so more and more, they started promoting the Holocaust survivors as important people. So that was a change, and so they want to now show in any way they can that these survivors were brave and, you know, doing all this resistance work. So another point, is that, yeah, well, I think this is an example of how the Jews have their own everything. I already mentioned that, but things that are shared with everyone, which they want everyone to share in, is not enough for them. They have to have something of their own. I already went into that, and this is just another one that they're doing. And they say, they don't want to include non-Jews, and yet they do. See how they want to have it all? They don't want to include non-Jews, but they want non-Jews to pay all kinds of respects to what they're doing. And they do want to install all their stuff in the United States, because I believe the United States is designated to be their country, just like Israel is today. I mean, it's going to be bigger, stronger, and they're going to have more power. They're going to totally own the United States. And so the United States will be having all of these kinds of traditions and beliefs and so on, following it as, for the Jews. But if you're non-Jewish here, you're going to be a third class citizen. See, you're not going to have all the rights, but you're going to be here, as under their control and under their domination. So talking about this holiday again, just some of the places that are, having services and so on for it. At Bard College, they list this Yom HaShoah as a Jewish holiday. They have holidays of all the different religious faiths there. And Yom HaShoah is listed as a Jewish holiday along with Passover and Purim and Israel Independence Day. So, for Israel, it's a holiday. It's, as I already said, it's not that here yet. It's just a day of commemoration, which is authorized and mandated by Congress. And that Holocaust Museum is given the authorization to lead the whole thing. So in the Twin Cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, they have a big commemoration at the Adath Jeshurun congregation, but they have them all over the area and all over the Twin Cities. And at this one, this year, this is really important, the 2013 Remembrance Day commemoration will feature, and they call it Yom HaShoah too, they use both names, will feature, well, of course, these are Jews who wrote this. This is a Jewish, kind of like a Jewish release, press release from the Twin Cities. They're gonna feature Eli Rosenbaum at their commemoration to give the big speech and so on. And he is the director of the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. And he is described as being the longest serving prosecutor and investigator of Nazi criminals in history. Now, this man is somebody, who I really don't like, don't even like the looks of him. I even looked at a video that he was on. I could only watch a few minutes and I had to turn it off. Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section is what was the old OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, that did so much damage from the end of World War II to, until it was, I can't think of the word, it was ended just in 2010. In 2010, they dissolved that OSI, but they just shifted it into another department called Human Rights and Special Prosecutions. And the OSI has such a bad reputation, and it done so many bad things, even illegal things and so on. And so they finally trashed it, but they just switched it over to this other thing they call a section in the Department of Justice. And he is the director. And, looking at that online, they have a woman without a Jewish name. I think her last name is McHenry. And she's not the director. She's the head person that they list. You know, she's like a member of the Justice Department, and she kind of oversees this. One of her jobs is to oversee this department. But this department is run totally by this Eli Rosenbaum, and you can't find a list of all the people who work there. Because I guess they don't want you to see that it's all Jewish names, but they're all Jews. And they're always Jews in the OSI, and they're all Jews here too. It's like there's another one. We have the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and then we have this Human Rights and Special Prosecutions in the Justice Department. Then in the State Department, there's that department or section that is, they have the special envoy to combat anti-Semitism around the world. And that's that woman, who runs it now. You know, I didn't have time to go look for that. But I think, you know, I thought her name might come to me, but it still hasn't. But Hannah somebody or something. Anyway, there's a woman now who runs that, and she's traveling around. She's got a huge budget too. And you have the same question. Why are the taxpayers of the United States and these departments, and these are cabinet departments, you know, under the president. This is all under the president of the United States, to go around combating anti-Semitism around the world. Well, here, he's fighting for human rights and special prosecutions all around the world. But it's only of one type. You know, it's to go after Nazi type or Nazi related or anything like that. Although they go after some others now, but this is what they spend a lot of time doing. And let's see, what else do I have here? Okay. Well, they say on this. I'm going to say more about him. Let me get to it before I go on. Where is that? Well, oh, I'm confused. Yeah, here it is. No, that's not it. Well, anyway, it'll come up here. Maybe it's right here. So, they say on this, in this same write-up for the Twin Cities Yom HaShoah commemoration, They make a point of saying that it honors the memory of 6 million Jews and other victims. You know, 6 million Jews and other victims murdered in the Holocaust. As always, the main thing is that survivors are invited to light candles. And in this one, members of the Children of Holocaust Survivors Association in Minnesota, CHAIM, will assist in the lighting of candles. See, children of the Holocaust survivors, we know that, and probably children of Holocaust survivors will be able to go on and on and on into perpetuity, because even if you're a great 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 grandchild, you could still be thought of as a child of Holocaust survivors. So, you know, that there's no end there. They don't want that to come to an end. They have to have some people representing Holocaust survivors forever. And they're going to assist the people in lighting a candle. I take it that some of these Holocaust survivors are so decrepit that they can't even light a candle by themselves, or they can't find their way from their seat to go to go to where the candles are. So these younger people will have to assist them. And it tells you that it's sponsored, this particular one, like all of them. They're all this way. It's co-sponsored, this commemoration event, by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, which is called JCRC, and the Children of the Holocaust Survivors Association. That's the one I just talked about. The Adath Jeshurun Congregation, the Jewish Federation of Greater St. Paul, and the Minneapolis Jewish Federation. And that's why all these things are. It's all these Jewish federations get together and they sponsor this and they make a big deal out of it and they make it seem real important. But it's all Jews there, probably. There's not going to be too many non-Jews there. But they get non-Jews to read about it in their papers and so on and know that it's going on and feel that it's appropriate, you know, it's appropriate. It's what we do, you know, what should be done here. So another one, is the, they're going to have one at the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. These are ones that I just found online. And, you know, the Museum of Tolerance in Southern California, that's, that other guy, can't come up with his name right now either. Wiesenthal, Simon Wiesenthal. That's part of his big network, that he built. And of course they do that at these places. And in South Palm Beach County, I'm afraid Palm Beach County is a terrible place. I used to live there. And, I had no idea what kind of people were there, you know. I didn't think about that then, but, that is a really strong Jewish, influence there. And, in southeastern Virginia, also lots of Jews around there. And there's a whole, federation, United Jewish Federation of Tidewater, it's called. And it takes in all these communities, you know, in that area, including, Norfolk and, I had them listed here, but, you know, a lot of them are, names are familiar of the towns there, but, you know, they do this all together. And this is another interesting story. This year, they're going to feature Frank Grunewald. And, what they say about Frank Grunewald is that, memories of life during the Holocaust, seep into his mind all the time. And he says, every day, maybe 15 times or maybe 30, he has memories of the Holocaust. And every third or fourth situation, he says, triggers a memory. He can't get away from it. And it was a long time ago, you know, for him. He's pretty old. And that goes back 65 years, he says. Everything triggers it. Eating a piece of dark bread triggers it. Putting on a pair of shoes in the winter triggers it. Picking up my grandchild triggers it. Knowing that so many kids, beautiful kids, were killed. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Why? You know, why are there all these kids and all these survivors from when they're there as children if so many were killed? That's one of the big lies of this big fat hoax. And he says the memories haven't stopped him from speaking about his childhood to others, however. So even though he has to remember it all the time, it's so painful, he still goes out and talks about it wherever he can to others, hoping that they'll learn from his experience, blah, blah, blah. So then another interesting one, and this is where some of this information is stuck, in the where did it go? I just popped my page up. The Holocaust Center in Boston North. See, I've got a few minutes left here. At the, in Boston North, that, you know, area of Boston, they have something called the Holocaust Center. Naturally, probably they have a bunches of them. But, so they say in their write-up that the tradition for a Holocaust Remembrance Week began in 1979 under the directive of President Jimmy Carter, when the United States Senate and Congress recognized the need to perpetuate the history of the Holocaust. Now, I found this to be a really basic question. You know, why do we do this? Why did Congress do this? But because they just use this excuse, but they say because there is a need to perpetuate the history of the Holocaust. All right. So if there's a need to do something, well, the United States should be doing it. Because we're the leader of the free world, I guess. You know, I'm giving them reasons. That they might justify what they've done, and that we're supposed to remember the victims. You know, there's a need here in the United States to perpetuate the Holocaust history and remember those victims. You know, and of course, why? There isn't. But they created the U.S. Memorial Council. And that's the one that was headed by Elie Wiesel. Jimmy Carter went along with that. And that was the forerunner of the museum, the museum memorial. So they created this council run by Elie Wiesel. And there are people who didn't even want him heading it and didn't like the way he handled it. But he was very, very big in the formation of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. He played a big role in that, as he has done all this political stuff always. So they established the U.S. Memorial Council, established the week of Yom HaShoah as the days of remembrance of the victims of the Holocaust, it says here. And then after that, they went ahead and got the museum built. So they had already established that commemoration officially sanctioned here in the United States. And it says that the Israeli parliament, 60 seconds. This again is this Warsaw Ghetto thing. All right. Okay. So at, I'll just finish this. In Israel, when they do this every year, at 8 a.m. on the day, the air raid sirens will sound throughout the streets of Israel, and all normal activity will cease for 2 minutes as a silent tribute, you know, to the 6 million. And on that day, a national program is held in the courtyard of the Yad Vashem. And that is what is happening here. We don't have the air raid sirens yet and the forced 2 minute silence, but that would probably be happening in the future. So, ladies and gentlemen, I have a lot more to go here, and we're ready for our break. And the music is, if I get this woman's name right for a change, Moya, I think her name is pronounced Moya Erdman, who is singing the beautiful aria of Mozart. So I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you get put into such a nice mood from that music, and then I have to come back and just break in a very ordinary way. But this is Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and the subject of today's program is, I have to go back and look at it, is, anti-Yom HaShoah. I didn't mention that in the beginning, but I'm against that this day, and because it, and we do need to know that it's Israel's Holocaust Day. That song that we just heard is titled Ruah Sanft, which is sleep safely. The singer is singing to a person who is sleeping and kind of looking over in a protective way, protective, loving way. So now to move on, I just lost my place by jumping up. Okay. I thought I would just mention real quickly that you may have heard this story about the hackers, and that, I have a sense that Israel is pushing this. This is the Mossad pushing this, saying that there's this plot by these hackers to strike Israel's online presence, on this, Yom HaShoah Day to take down a bunch of their largest websites in their country, like banks, credit card companies and communications firms. And so there's been quite a few stories about it. Don't know whether it's going to happen, but if it does, I'm not even too impressed that it's real. Anyway, they like to always make demonstrations that they're under attack. You know, that's their favorite thing. That's what they have to keep going. And we're going to talk about that a lot in this hour. So, now I have the material on this, human rights and special prosecution section in the Justice Department that's run by this Eli Rosenbaum. And it, says that it primarily investigates and prosecutes, cases that, genocide, torture, war crimes, and recruitment or use of child soldiers. So, and also immigrant and naturalization fraud arising out of efforts to hide their involvement in such crimes. So they're not really talking about immigrants or illegal immigrants or anything like that, that kind of fraud. They're talking about other kind of people who come in as legal, but they've hidden their crimes. And so, you know, that's what they say about a lot of these poor, I guess you'd say veterans of World War II on the German side that they keep hunting down and trying to make them out to be war criminals. So they, it says that, I don't know how important this is, In addition to the prosecutorial activities, this HRSP, for short, is actively engaged in policy work, both domestically and internationally. So, you know, they're not only prosecutors in the Justice Department. They're making the policy about how to handle human rights violators, who they are and what should be done about them, and so on. It's all Jews. It's all Jews who are making policy about human rights violators in the Justice Department. I don't know if there's other agencies in there that are doing part of that, but here's an example of someone that I don't know if this, well, it would have been the OSI, but of, that was targeted for human rights violations. And this is Kurt Waldheim. I mentioned him in a previous show, and then I was not sure. Said I thought he had something to do with the United Nations. And then I thought, oh, maybe he didn't. But he did. He was the fourth Secretary General of the United Nations from 1972 to 1981. He was an Austrian, and he was in the Wehrmacht in World War II, naturally, like most of them of his age. And He was born in 1918, died in 2007, but I don't know why he was elected to the general to be Secretary General of the United Nations. I don't know what he had done, but he had a very good reputation, and not that I would like, you know, not that I would support a, you know, being a, the head of the United Nations, but that's what he was. And then he became the ninth president of Austria. And that was from 1986 to 1992. And when he was running for president for in Austria in 1985, after he had been Secretary General of the United Nations for 9 years, his service as an intelligence officer in the Wehrmacht during World War II was looked into and caused a big controversy. And, of course, then they have to say, the Wehrmacht was the armed forces of Nazi Germany, to explain why. Because if you're, you know, if you're an officer in any other army or military of any government anywhere in the world, you're not questioned. You're not, you know, you're not thought to be a war criminal because of it. But if you were in the armed forces of Nazi Germany, if you're in the Wehrmacht, no matter what you are doing, you're under suspicion for being some kind of a war criminal. In fact, you know, just being in the Wehrmacht is looked upon as something detrimental to you. And it is. It is. It does, you know, even though you're not guilty of any crime, well, it's a bad thing. In fact, in Austria, they went so far as to, have they done it yet? They voted to do it, to rehabilitate the deserters from the army at that time, from the Wehrmacht, who were Austrians, and build a big memorial monument to them as heroes, because they deserted the Wehrmacht brother. You know, that's really going too far. So the Austrians do some good things. They're basically nationalistic, but at the same time, they do some really awful things, and it's their politicians and leaders who do it and talk, you know, override the people for the most part and do things like this. But anyway, this election of this Waldheim affair is very revealing in how they do these things. So I'm going to go into it a little bit. They during his campaign for the presidency. There was an investigative journalist, Alfred Wurm, W-O-R-M, who revealed in the Austrian, in a major news magazine, that there had been omissions about Waldheim's life between 1938 and 1945 in his recently published autobiography. And then a short time later, the World Jewish Congress alleged that Waldheim had lied about his service as an officer in the Mounted Corps of the SA. He had been in the SA, and his time as an ordnance officer for Army Group E in Saloniki, Greece, where they like to point out all these atrocities by the Germans in Saloniki when they had, I guess, a big battle there. They had a lot of people doing atrocities to the Germans, and the Germans were doing some reprisals, I know that. But anyway, in the files of the United Nations War Crimes Commission, well, you know what that's like. Establishment commissions that are set up to look at things, they don't look at things honestly. But in those files, there was supposedly, some proof of this, or some claims of this. And Waldheim called these things pure lies and malicious acts. He said none of it was true, what they found there. But nevertheless, he admitted that he had known about German reprisals against partisans. Now, what is wrong with German reprisals against partisans? See, there was never anything wrong with anybody else's reprisals against partisans, and what these partisans were doing were pretty terrible, so naturally they had to do reprisals. I'm all for it. I 100%. And yet, these Germans and Austrians and so on who were participating today, you know, later they had to say, oh, no, I wouldn't, I didn't know, or else, oh, I would never have done that. Oh, that's terrible. Even though they know that's not true. But because, you know, they're politicians, they do it. It's not very admirable. But he said, Waldheim said, yes, I knew about them. I was horrified. But what could I do? I had either to continue to serve or be executed. Well, that's true. And that's, everybody knows that. As a lower level officer or whatever he was, you know, you can't tell your higher ups what to do. You can't say, well, I don't go along with this. I won't go along with this. You can't do it. So anyway, he went on to say that he had never fired a shot or even seen a partisan. And his immediate superior at that time made a statement that Waldheim had remained confined to a desk during the whole time, that he was not out there, you know, in the action. So he couldn't have been doing any of that. And a former Austrian chancellor, Bruno Kreisky, who was of Jewish origin, but had his loyalties in the right place, pretty much, I guess. He denounced the actions of the World Jewish Congress as an extraordinary infamy. And he added that Austrians would not, quote, allow the Jews abroad to tell us who should be our president, which was good of him, you know, good statement. But nobody could go so far as to say that the Germans were not guilty of what they're being accused of, and that all these Wehrmacht soldiers were, you know, were just doing what any other soldier would be doing, and so on. No, nobody could say that, but they did try to defend Waldheim, or Waldheim, against these accusations that had been stirred up against him. And then the person who wrote about this was doing some editorializing and said that a part of the reason for this controversy, but that's not the reason, was the Jews. But part, he says, that it was Austria's refusal to address its national role in the Holocaust, and added that many, you know, like Hitler was an Austrian. And that somehow makes Austrians guilty in itself. And Austria became part of the Third Reich. And so Austria was, you know, just as guilty as all the other, as Germany, which is actually true. But it was the Allies who encouraged Austria to not take that route and to separate itself from Germany and say it didn't really want to ever be there to begin with. So, one good thing Austria did was, they refused to pay compensation to Nazi victims because they said they weren't responsible for what happened to them. So they refused to pay the compensation that was asked of them. And from 1970 onwards, they refused to investigate Austrian citizens who were senior Nazis. And I like that about them, too, because they did. Because the whole society in Germany, too, were full of these former Nazis. I mean, everybody was a Nazi, so they're full of all these people. And these were their neighbors and the people they knew and their you know, their fellow people, you know, fellow Germans, fellow, well, they're all Germans, you know, their neighbors and so on, people they knew. They weren't going to investigate all these people. And they didn't want to investigate these senior Nazis either because they liked them, you know. Everybody, they weren't bad people. And also, stolen Jewish art remained public property until after this Waldheim affair. So they wouldn't go, they wouldn't listen to the Jews about their stolen art and give it all back to them either. That all came later, you know, as this pressure just kept coming on them. So, another interesting part of this is that a declassified CIA document showed that the CIA had been aware of Waldheim's wartime past since 1945. So there was nothing about Waldheim's life that, you know, and his involvement in the war and, you know, as a soldier and so on, that they didn't know. And it was also previously published by a pro-German Austrian newspaper, it says, pro-German Austrian newspaper, during the 1971 presidential election, which they say, there was also in there a claim of an that he was a member of the SS, but they say that the matter was supposedly regarded as unimportant and even advantageous for the candidate at that time. So in 1971, to call Waldheim to say, to pass on a rumor that he was in the SS, which I guess he was not, but, was actually good for him because the people held nothing against the SS and they actually secretly, you know, really liked it. And this is how things have changed. And this has been remarked upon many times that in the 50s, 60s, even up into the early 1970s, the people of the former Reich, were still supportive of the Reich, and they didn't find anything. They didn't believe most of this stuff, you know. They didn't believe the stories. They didn't believe the Nuremberg trials because they knew what they were. They were victor's justice. They were just a bunch of hot air, and they didn't believe any of that stuff. And that was, and we know that it was in the 70s, like mid 70s and moving on along, that this Holocaust thing, this push to make the Holocaust a big, big deal, was underway. And so this fits into that timeline very well. A little more, is there anything more about him I want to say? well, his biography that he wrote was In the Eye of the Storm, and everybody knew about it, and he had a lot of stuff in there. And then there were rumors that the KGB had blackmailed him during his UN time. Blackmailed him over what? I don't know. That's probably just rumors, and that's all it ever was. And but you know, this was during the anti-communist time. And a long article in the Washington Post wrote about possible Soviet blackmail. Well, that's not really any. Well, here's the part. In 1994, Viktor Ostrovsky, you know, that former Mossad officer that turned and wrote books and gave interviews and told a lot of stuff about the Soviet Union. Ostrovsky claimed in his book, The Other Side of Deception, that Mossad doctored the file of the then UN Secretary General, that's Waldheim, to implicate him in Nazi crimes. This is kind of the Mossad, right? Now, these allegedly false documents were subsequently, quote, discovered, unquote, by Benjamin Netanyahu in the UN file and triggered the Waldheim affair. So they, according to Ostrovsky, the Jews were behind all this, as they're behind hundreds of these things to just make, you know, push their narrative of how things went and make all these people guilty, especially Germans. And Waldheim, even though we call him an Austrian, he is a German. He is a German. He was, I guess he's dead now. Well, there's a lot that's of interest there, but I will move on and just give this little item about that, of how we should be reacting to these things. That the Golden Dawn Party, there's one of their members who's pretty high up, I guess, Ioannis Lagos, I-O-A-N-N-I-S, Ioannis Lagos. And this is an old story from February. He told the parliament, the Greek parliament, in February, he's a member of the parliament from the Golden Dawn Party, that it was unacceptable. That's a quote, unacceptable, that Greeks commemorated International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Well, it is unacceptable. I think now that's a, he got in trouble for that, but that's a great statement. And he's talking about the one in January. But, you know, here in the United States, we not only commemorate that one, but we commemorate the one in April, too. But nobody says anything. We don't have anybody standing up in our Congress who will say that it's unacceptable and we shouldn't be doing it, at least for the second one. You know, it just start there. Now, going on to Abe Foxman, and on 2 days ago, on April 4th, he came off with his, on the ADL site, on the Holocaust Memorial Day, this April one. And he writes, Jews around the world commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day, or Yom HaShoah, as it is known in Hebrew, on April 7th this year, You know, and he again says that, you know, what we do, we light candles and remember the 6 million whose lives were cut short by the Nazis. And then he says, we take a moment to reflect on the nature of hatred. Wait a minute. I get it. Something popped up on my screen. I got to get rid of it. Okay. We take a moment to reflect on the nature of hatred and ask why and how so many people could so the orders of a genocidal lunatic, meaning Hitler, in his single-minded purpose, of persecuting and killing millions of innocent men, women, and children. So, you know, this is the kind of thing he says every chance he gets. And he talks about how he was saved, you know, and too bad, you know, that miraculously, well, that some Catholic Polish woman, dumb Polish woman, took him in and protected him, took him away from his parents. They gave him up for her to protect him, and he survived. He would have survived anyway because he says, miraculously, my parents survived the Holocaust and returned to reclaim me. So they were not, you know, at least he doesn't say that they were murdered in the gas chambers. He was only 5 years old at that time. And then he goes on about the lessons. And he says, and this is what's important because I hadn't even thought about it. This year, the Anti-Defamation League is commemorating 100 years since our founding in 1913. This is the centennial of the Anti-Defamation League. I don't recall anybody talking about that. But he talked about it here, in conjunction with the Days of Remembrance. And he says a great deal has changed since the climate of rampant anti-Semitism that existed in America in the early 20th century. You see this kind of talk that goes on? This is the kind of talk that gets more and more and more into our, into the written record of our times or whatever. And people, you know, some people listen to it. That in the early 20th century, there was rampant anti-Semitism in this country and a deep vein of Jew hatred that spawned the birth of this important institution, meaning the Anti-Defamation League, and assured its growth through the intervening decades. Well, you know, as is emphasized, and again, the International Jew that Hattie Scott and I are reading, you know, there was a big influx of Jews to the United States around 1900, before, after, around that time. Huge. And then they just kept coming, and mostly Russian and Polish Jews, of which he is a typical example. And, Abe Foxman. But there was no Jew hatred. You know, all these Jews were allowed in. Millions of Jews came into this country. And there wasn't any anti-Semitism that showed up until after they were here and normal American white people had to be around them and started to notice what they were doing and started to dislike what they were doing. That's what it's all about, really. But again, we have to tolerate these stories from these people. And the more control they have, the more we're going to hear this kind of thing as in a way that you can't really speak out against it. So, you know, their theme for their centennial is imagine a world without hate. Again, always, always going on and on about hate. And he says, he talks about Anne Frank and stuff like that. Here's people he lists as victims of hate crimes. Martin Luther King Jr., Harvey Milk, a Jew, Daniel Pearl, a Jew, Matthew Shepard, he's a homosexual, Yitzhak Rabin, I guess it's pronounced, is a Jew, an Israeli. Each had his life cut short by hatred. Jeez. In his centennial article, he tells a few things about the ADL. And he says it was founded in 1913 to combat anti-Semitism and all forms of bigotry and hate. And the theme for their centennial is Imagine a World Without Hate. And they hope to make that a reality. So what is, you know, of course, what we know is that it was founded, it was created to attack anyone who criticizes the Jews. That and what they were doing. That's what it was founded for. Because there was criticism of the Jews, and they can't allow any criticism, so they founded this thing, and then they pretend that they're combating anti-Semitism and bigotry and hate. And he says, here again, he uses this word, our country. He says, ADL is dedicated to making our country a more inclusive home for all, where being different is not a liability and diversity is a cherished strength. And tells people to join him, all right, in his discussion about, you know, in their different centennial activities that they're having. Now, you know, their ADL is dedicated to making this country, is what he should say, to making this country a more inclusive home for all. But of course, what he means is against our interests, and it's what he means is to have more, you know, more immigrants. More Jews, more colored people, more all kinds of people, where they will just push out, you know, and the white people. And finally, our birth rate will be so low and so bad, and that we'll just, you know, become a very small minority. But he, again, they always notice, they always use that word, our country. I resent that, I can tell you that. Now, let me move on to Ken Walzer and the Jewish Studies programs. Because this is in line with how they do their job of taking things over. And it again reveals why they have come as far as they have come and how and why we can't stop them. You know, we can't stop them. There's no way to stop these people as long as they're allowed to be here and do their thing. So, Ken Walzer is head of the Jewish Studies program at Michigan State University. He has been for many years. And I've written about him at the just recently, a new post up at Elie Wiesel Cons the World. And I would, if you haven't read that, I would encourage you to go and read it. And I'm going to be writing more about Walzer. But also, Elie Wiesel has a role in Boston University with the Jewish Studies program. And I've written about that in the past at the Elie Wiesel Tattoo website. And the Jewish Studies Center is named after Elie Wiesel at Boston University. And quoting from their website, a unit of the College of Arts and Sciences, the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, EWCJS, supports students and faculty working in all areas related to Jewish history, culture, and religion. The center is housed, you know, in one of the most elegant historical buildings on campus. Now, did you know that there's also something called Israel Studies at Boston University? Well, I didn't know that, but I found that out. And it says on that page of Israel Studies, which is kind of linked to the Judaic Studies Center, it says in fall, and this is just another example of how they go about this. So think about it that way as you're listening to this. In the fall 2013, Dr. Abigail Jacobson will teach a course on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The course counts toward concentrations in history, the minor in Jewish studies, as well as toward the concentration in the IR Africa Middle East track. Excuse me. Dr. Jacobson took her B.A. from Tel Aviv University in 1997 and her Ph.D. from the University of Chicago in 2006. She is the author of this book about the Ottoman Empire and British rule and currently serves as a junior fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. That's a Jewish university. She has taught at the New York University Tel Aviv program, and as well as the School for Government and International Program RRIS, Interdisciplinary Center, IDC, of Herzliya, Israel. So, you know, there's the Israeli, how we've got, already we've got Tel Aviv University, the Middle East Studies at Brandeis, New York University Tel Aviv program, and this Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya, Israel. And in the fall of 2012, she served as a visiting researcher in Israel Studies at the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. So you see how they work their way from Jewish schools and programs into mainstream U.S. schools, and also mainstream their personal Jewish issues, you know, so that what these issues about Jews and Israel and the Middle East and so on, all this is very, very important. And more and more we have to talk about this in our universities and have special schools and, you know, units for this and so on. And everything of importance then is about the Jews. That it gets to be that way more and more. This is said a lot in a generalized way, but it brings it home much better when you look at an individual instance like this woman and how her deep, deep Israeli Jewish connections are there, and yet she manages to get into also into mainstream universities and influence what's going on there, and influence those students who aren't Jews. And so these, you know, instances of this woman are multiplied thousands of times elsewhere. You know, just think of it. Over and over and over again, this is going on. And this is what I mean when I say we can't keep them out. We can't control these people. We can't have them around and keep them out of influential positions and out of our institutions and so on. This is what you see a lot of people say. They say, well, I mean, even well, Professor McDonald was on one with Tan on this program a few weeks ago. And he cannot say, and, you know, I like him and respect him very much, but he cannot say, well, we have to keep them out. We have to get rid of them. We can't have them and so on. You know, no person in his position, or many people who want to feel like have to have respect and what have you, can say that. Yet he'll say, well, we need to keep them out of important positions. We need to keep them out of, well, I must have gone off the air or something. All of a sudden I don't have any listeners, but I have less than half of what I had a minute ago. Okay. Well, we have to keep them out of, positions of authority, but, you know, there's no way to do that. There is no way to do that. Back to this Boston University Elie Wiesel Jewish Studies Program page. They say, what do Gershom Scholem, Nahum N. Glatzer, Marvin Fox, and Elie Wiesel have in common? All of these distinguished scholars taught at Boston University. Boston University has a long and distinguished record in the area of Jewish studies, including the presence on its faculty for 36 years of Elie Wiesel, our center's namesake, and the 1986 Nobel Laureate for Peace. We are pleased to support the ongoing work of cataloging the archives of Professor Wiesel. And then they tell you to contact Howard Gottlieb for archival research center details. Now, so, you know, I say, you can see that these people are everywhere. They're everywhere, and they're all making good money at these universities. The overrepresentation of Jews in universities, not only as professors and students, but as employees, you know, in all kinds of areas in the universities, is outrageous. Now, that's one point. But the other point is that Elie Wiesel will be honored and idealized at Boston University forever. I mean, it's written in stone already. They're never going to admit that he has ever told a small lie, let alone the major fraud of his whole story. You know, they won't admit anything about him. He's already, you know, being idealized and idolized by that university. And that university is not going away. You know, it's a big, major university. Of course, it's highly funded by Jews, but more and more of them are. So, you know, we cannot expect any of that to change. It's not going to change. I don't care how much work revisionists do and what can be proved about Elie Wiesel. They're not going to listen to it, and they're going to continue to name things after him and try to, you know, make him a hero, which so many people are doing. So this is where I say, you know, it just doesn't work. It says that continuing on with what they wrote there, the work of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies is made possible by the generous support of our friends across the region who enable us to offer stipends and scholarships to undergraduate and graduate students, support faculty and student research and travel, build the Judaica Library Collection at BU, and so on. So who funds all this? Jews. Generous support from Jews across the region who, you know, give money for scholarships and books and, you know, all kinds of facilities there and this is why we have so many of them, because they're funded by the Jews. Now, here's a little piece about the rise of Jewish studies programs that I took from a website, Jewish, of course, written by somebody named Greenspan, and I just took some parts of it. And it says, the initial funding for Judaic studies programs has typically been external, resulting in a high proportion of endowed chairs in Judaic studies. So they mean that it's not coming from within the university, but outside the university. And all these wealthy Jews, or they're wealthy enough, Jews are offering to endow chairs. So they have a lot of professors of Judaic studies, you know, so that they will create a Judaic studies program. They have the personnel to do it. And it says, although this clearly demonstrates the Jewish community's desire for such programs, the Jewish community's desire, and has ensured their survival, even when analogous programs are being discontinued, it also reflects a lack of commitment on the part of the universities where they are housed. So, you know, they say that critically, because, oh, the universities are not that interested in these Judaic study programs, but the Jews are giving the money and funding and promoting and pushing so on to have them, but they're not too happy because they want us to really want them too. And so they say one indicator of the discipline's success has been the growth of the Association for Jewish Studies, AJS, which began in 1969. Okay, this association was formed in 1969. With 47 members, and it now, at this writing, it was over 1,500 members. So it's grown quite a lot. It's just an association to promote Jewish studies around the country. And they say that, they're made up. They're made up mostly of people whose training and interests are specifically rooted in Judaic studies rather than in other fields such as history or literature. Now, Ken Walzer is a professor of history. He actually got his PhD in history at Harvard. Now, I don't think he seems to be a real great, have a lot of brain power, and he doesn't seem, but I guess he knows how to deal with the system, how what he's supposed to do, and he probably got a lot of help, and he fits the profile of what they want. So he got his degree as a history professor, and he's supposed to be an expert in German history. And his name is German, but he never will say. Now, he won't say on his Wikipedia web page who his parents are or what his religion is. And he is so Jewish and so pro-Israel. I mean, it just seeps out of him everywhere. But he still doesn't seem to want to say or put out the information that he's a Jew or that his religion is Judaism or anything like that. Nor do we know only that he was born in New York. But we don't have names or anything for his parents, which is kind of, it's a bit, when when people, when that, when you see that, like with that, president of Kent State College, Lefton, you see that. They're hiding that. They just don't want to be identified. They think they can get away without being identified as a Jew because everything they do is so pro-Jewish. These Judaic studies programs were kind of flowering in the 60s and 70s, but they actually traced their origins back 40 years earlier to the two towering figures of this movement for Jewish studies in American universities, and that is Salo Baron and Harry Austin Wolfson. And Baron was trained in Vienna, that Jew-infested place, and came to the United States to teach at New York's Jewish Institute of Religion. Now, that's how they get here. He's a Jew in Vienna, got to the United States by being having this job to teach at New York's Jewish Institute of Religion. And after that, he eventually got a part-time appointment at Columbia. See how he got into Columbia? Part-time in the beginning. And he started out with these other places. And then Wolfson is a Lithuanian Jew, Harry Wolfson. That doesn't sound like a Lithuanian name, does it? But he studied at what is now Yeshiva University's Rabbi Isaac Elhanan Theological Seminary. And then he received his academic, while he was doing that, he got his academic training at Harvard. So he was actually a seminary student. And he had, you know, they had this agreement that they could take their other subjects at Harvard. And then he was allowed to join the faculty in the early 1920s, having also taught at the Jewish, that other Jewish Institute of Religion, previously. So they get their experience in their Jewish institutions, and they get to the United States that way, and then they eventually get themselves into a mainstream institution, even though Columbia is, Harvard and Columbia are both known to have a lot of Jewish influence and be very Jewish. But so I think that Ken Walzer is probably a protege of Wolfson during his at Harvard, And he was picked as someone who was single-mindedly enough to do to go on and create more Jewish studies programs. And Bernard Cooperman writes that the first regular professorship of Jewish studies at a secular university had not come until the 1920s, when Harry Wolfson, this is the guy we're talking about, was appointed at Harvard, and Salo Baron at Columbia. So they, by their getting their appointments at these mainstream universities, they broke into it, and more, Jewish studies were had to be taken seriously, I guess. It says that Leon Jick, J-I-C-K, was the first president of the Association for Jewish Studies, and he said much the same thing. He said, quote, "In the recent past, the pursuit of Jewish studies was virtually unknown in a secular American university, aside from chairs at Harvard, Columbia, and Yale." That's pretty interesting, isn't it? The first chairs in Jewish studies were at Harvard, at Columbia, and at Yale. Very elite universities. But very open to Jews. And the Jewish presence on most college campuses was limited to student service organizations up until then, and an occasional lectureship. So, the Jews didn't have influence in our universities until they started getting in and they started pushing this Jewish studies. And it says that the earliest element of Judaic studies to be taught on American campuses was Hebrew. So that was like a acceptable subject for people, students to learn Hebrew, and they needed Jews to teach Hebrew, and you needed Hebrew to read all these old Hebrew texts and so on. And this was, you know, legitimate scholarship. Now, in 1992, the American Jewish Studies Association, I guess, published, no, a publication called American Jewish Studies. Is that what it is? Association of Jewish Studies, I'm sorry, AJS, published Jewish Studies courses at American and Canadian universities, a catalog which listed over 4,000 courses in higher learning with Jewish Studies courses, 104 endowed academic positions, and 1,300 members in the American Jewish Studies, Association of Jewish Studies, which is a far cry from what they started out with. Okay, so by 1992, they were going pretty strongly. And this is another way that they have gotten themselves so established, because you at any big university, you're going to find a big Jewish Studies department and a big program, and they get all kinds of Jews in there to teach in it and work in it. Now, let's see. Okay, what do I want to end up with here? I think I will go ahead with this article about Putin, because I think it fits in pretty well. And this was in the news recently. And it's at www.jamestown.org. And it's titled, I guess this is the title, that's what I put here, Putin, I think I wrote this, revising history to accord with the facts, not in Russia's interest. So, you know, another aspect of this is that the difficulty we have in historical revisionism, just a great difficulty, because it's in everybody's interest not to change the current narrative about Germany, World War II, Holocaust, the whole thing, you know. And in this article, it says that Vladimir Putin asserted, well, he's become a real strong nationalist, just to introduce this. And people applaud that. At times I thought, oh, that's great to hear him talk like that, you know. But it's Russian nationalism, and it can really conflict with other people's nationalism. And he wants to assert Russian nationalism, or the Russian narrative, the Russian history. He wants to assert the history that makes the Russians look good, or the way they want it to be, over other people. So it's not good, you know. And he cooperates with Israel partly, you know, in, well, I don't know if it's partly for those reasons, but partly in the way in order to keep this history, because they both want to keep this history. And they both want to, you know, commemorate the Holocaust every time you turn around. And they both want to blame the Germans and the Nazis and never forgive and so on. So they have this in common. So you can't just see Putin as a good guy because he's looking out for the nationalist interests of Russia. I don't mind him doing that. But he then objects when other people look out for their national interests. Now, he asserted that the Bolsheviks used Finnish armed formations in quotes, for executing the coup on October 1917. So this, I guess, is not true in real history. I don't know too much. I don't know, really know about that. But he, even more remarkable, it says, was his reinterpretation of the Winter War with Finland as not an act of aggression aimed at subjugating a neighbor that rejected the communist model, but merely an attempt to correct earlier mistakes of drawing the border too close to St. Petersburg. Well, I guess that's really outrageous, but these are things that he said recently in his attempt to downplay the fact that Russia, that the Soviet Union was such a terrible aggressor against Finland, and not have that be the way the history states, at least. And they're rewriting all the history books in Russia to make everything conform to what they want their history to be also. Well, that sounds very Stalinistic, doesn't it? Now, he conceded that the first months of that Finnish war, the war with Finland, were bloody and inefficient. But then he concluded on a positive note that necessary forces were eventually mobilized and everything fell into their right places, so that the other side felt the entire might of the Russian which was then Soviet state. Now, he seemed to think that this was okay, that the other side needed to feel the entire might of the Soviet state. That was, that everything fell into place. I can't, you know, interpret this too well, and I won't even try. I'm just reading what it's saying. But he says that this glorification of Stalin's militaristic expansionism speaks volumes about Putin's perception of the modern world and Russia's place in it. Well, and I don't know if the people writing this article, what I would think of them if they're right wing, left wing, you know, who they are, and they might be, you know, have a particular idea about what they want their readers to think. But I just know that Putin is doing this with history, and that he, I already said those things, so I won't repeat them. So now it says the authorities in Russia are currently waging a massive campaign of patriotic reinvention of Russian history, religion, and even literature. They're getting rid of literature they don't think makes the Russians look good. And, you know, I mean, they're just doing all kinds of things, not what you call anything. It's okay to be nationalistic, but it's not okay to deny the truth and to be that, you know, turn things around that much. So it says that he seeks to harness the tradition of, these are the criticisms of him, he seeks to harness the tradition of militarism, which cuts across the corrosive influence of liberal arts. And 51, they had a poll, and 51% of the respondents in Russia saw a direct military threat to Russia from other states, and 57% are confident the army can protect Russia against such a threat. Well, this is a result of what Putin is telling the people. And it's right or wrong, I suppose there are threats to Russia from, like, NATO. You know, you could see a threat. So I couldn't argue with that too much. But they're also erecting monuments to the heroes of the Russian-Finnish War, which makes the Finns very bad, very mad, you know, because the Finns really were victimized by the Russians, but the Russians now are not willing to admit it, and so on and so forth. So this is what's going on. He seems to be going down the same road as Stalin and his communist successors when it comes to history. So the great thawing that took place, you know, for a while, and all the admitting that the Russians did for a long time under Khrushchev and then others, that seems to be going back in the other direction now. Well, in the few minutes I have left, I'm glad that I have a little bit of moment here to say that if you want to see an accurate portrayal of history as it took place in an Austrian, a later Ostmark from 1938 to 45, a town in the late 1930s, read the beautiful articles that I have posted at carolynyeager.net by Willy Wenger. There's two of them, by Willie. The Great Hope, the German Reich, was the first one. And then just the other day, I posted the follow-up to that, the referendum of April 10th, 1938. And this is through his eyes, some of it from things he wrote when he was young, and then later as he remembered how it was for him. And also the diary of his brother, Leopold Wenger, the portion that I have published so far, is the days of our revolution. And I'm sure a lot of you have already seen that, but if you haven't, I hope you would look at it. And there's going to be more coming from Willy Wenger that I'm just going to call the Wenger family archive. I'm going to have to put up another special archive section for the Willy Wenger family, just as I have done for Willy Chrisman. And have not made any more progress on it since I put it up. And there's a lot more to put on there. And I just want so much. This is one of my passionate interests and desires that I need more time for, is to get this material. A lot of it has to be translated. I have to scan lots of pictures and things, and I have to organize it all. The organizing is really time consuming. But I want to leave these archives as a permanent repository for these truthful stories of people from back at that time from Germans, these two Germans that I know, from back at that time and how it was and what they experienced. And, I do see things changing. A lot of people coming around, to the real truth about Hitler and the Third Reich, but, you know, the enemy is very strong and it's constantly working against it. So, we have to be sharp. And I think that I do want to end with what I started with, that, I feel very, very strongly that if we cannot accomplish what we want to accomplish as long as Jews are allowed to do their thing. And it's not because we're too weak and they're so much smarter. It's because of their tactics, the way they operate. And we have learned over and over again that we're not able to stop them and we're not able to keep them out. We're not able to say, well, you're not going to, you know, run our government. You're not going to do this. You're not going to do that, because they get in there. They always get in there. And once they get in there, they get more in there. And we've never found a way to deal with that. There's only one way. And that's the way that the National Socialists had realized, too, that you have to get them out of your country. Now, then the problem is they're still doing it somewhere else. But this is this has to be recognized, and I think it has to be recognized by revisionists, because I don't see that revisionism is going to win as long as these people have the kind of power they have and their power is growing. So these are big questions a lot of people don't want to look at, hate to look at. They don't want to make such a statement and think that such things have to be done, but I've come to the conclusion that they do have to be done, and it needs to be discussed. And naturally, we have to be very tough to do it. So I want to thank you very much for listening today. And I will be back next week for another program. So this is Carolyn Yeager signing off now. Have a nice week.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.